Welcome back. It's time once again for an adventure that we call Running Into Life, as we share the real-life stories of two women here running around the world. Just came back from the top of the world, Karen Ware and Nadia Ruiz. What the heck did you just do?
We just returned from Nepal, the Himalayas, the Everest Marathon, and Everest Base Camp.
Unbelievable.
And I'm going to give myself a little commercial disclaimer, elephant in the room, before we get started. You're going to see a patch right here, getting some skin stuff taken off, because I have been at high elevation. I've been to Everest Base Camp. This will be the third time. Been at the top of Kilimanjaro. But so has this beautiful lady. And so we have to talk to you and tell you guys about our amazing experience. But yeah, I had a little bit of skin sloughed off. And that's why
you got burned at high altitude.
The sunglasses I had actually reflected and burned the skin on there.
Oh,
so wear your sunscreen. And you see me kind of pushing this new Arbon product. And, you know, there's products, a lot of products out there, just because that's the one that the dermatologist told me I better start applying a little late in life, but here we go.
So when was this event? Let's just get the details out of the way. Nadia, this was your first time there, Nadia?
Yes, first time in the Himalayas and Nepal, and first time at Everest Base Camp.
Wow, but you've run, what was the record? You've been in like every continent or something here? I forgot the record that you set here a while ago here.
Yeah, my young, ripe age is in 20s. I was the youngest woman to run 100 marathons back in 2013.
Marathons. Wow, okay. So what made the you were in here before, if you guys want to go roll back and look at one of the early ones, talking about doing it. Now you're coming back and giving us a recap of what it was like. What was it like, Nadia? Was it everything you expected? Was it more? Was it different? Did it push yourself to the limits here?
Let's start with the air flight or the flight. Because this time in our history right now, a lot of flights are being canceled, and you have to fly, over or beyond Doha and Qatar
and
so a lot of people took flights to Hong Kong, and they were all filled up, and we got down to going through Istanbul, Turkey. And we only had like an hour and 10 minutes, I think, on the connection flight. So she can tell you about that and then take it from there. And how you travel, you have to just roll with all the things that, come up in travel.
It didn't go perfectly well. That's what I hear.
No, it never does. So you don't expect it to, and that makes half the story. So.
Yeah, so it was everything I expected and much, much more.
So when you got to Turkey, you made it, but you're... bags didn't. Is that what I understood here?
No, they did not. So it's about maybe 24 hours of travel, and we had a tight connection. It was about an hour, so we were rushing in the terminal. And of course, if we're rushing, I mean, they're not going to rush our baggage.
No.
So we made our connection. We were really happy about that when we got there. And then when I find out, like our luggage did not make it. So. Yes, they always say put in all your essentials into your carry-on. Problem is that when you're going on a two-week journey, it's very difficult to put all of your essentials in your carry-on only, especially if you're traveling to Nepal for the first time and you're doing it for the first time. You want to kind of overpack and bring all what you need. So my luggage didn't make it until about 2 days later.
They first
said 24 hours, and then it was 48 hours. And so that was extremely stressful. But at least Karen did prepare me and tell me, we need to have some wiggle room. And our guide also encouraged us to have some wiggle room before and after. And I was a little hesitant about the wiggle room, but of course now it's very important and to understand that.
Because we're used to, I can make a tight connection.
Well, the wiggle room is, we made that flight because this woman can run a 5.5 minute mile pace.
With a backpack on it?
She actually put her clock on, boom, and she clocked us, and she clocked the mileage, and it was...
Because you were you said the airport was 2 miles or something.
Yeah, 2 miles distance apart, and I think we were at least a mile and a half away from the connections.
Goodness.
And so that's, at my old age, that's my, top-end race pace. Chaser, and I was the last one on the airplane, and she's settled in and ready to roll.
So you got there. Now, so you were late? Were you delayed a day or two when you got to there?
No, we weren't. We weren't late. We had that two-day cushion room, and so we were just in the main city in Kathmandu. We checked in our hotel, trying to adjust. And I mean, it's a little bit easier for body clock-wise to adjust on the way over there. So once we were there, we ate, we just rested, and of course waited because expecting my luggage to be the next day. And once we found out, we find out the next day, like, no, sorry, it's going to be the next day. It's like, yeah. Oh, no. And so I try to be as calm as possible, be like, okay, well, this is out of our control. I mean, we just have to wait. And then Karen's like, no, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Like, I can't do anything. I'm not leaving without my luggage because I had everything in there that was really important for my trek.
Well, tell them what was important because it really is advantageous for you guys to know and hear. What made her do so well in the marathon is that she brought all of her own nutrition, and so there's some important stuff in there.
It's not just clothes or something.
Yeah, no, I'm very methodical in regards to like my gear and my nutrition, my hydration, everything that I've trained with that I know that I can use. Now, could I have survived it without it? Sure, I would have just had to buy products that were there that my body's probably not familiar with, and that's not a problem. Of course, that would have been an emergency that would have done that, but I try to optimize as much as possible everything that I'm using that I've tested out so that I can at least try to go for my peak performance if I can. So like I understood that the Everest Base Camp trek was going to be a spiritual journey. I wanted to actually try to test myself and push myself to do it as quickly as possible. Now that I've experienced it, I think I can. I think I actually can race the trek. But I would also be sacrificing the marathon. And so what I did was I shifted my mindset and saying, I'm going to race the marathon. And so let me enjoy this trek and be patient with each day as we go along.
Meaning that you have to go up slower.
Yes, right? Yes. And I just, again, I know my body really well. Last year I did Kilimanjaro, and I had hired a private guide to do Kilimanjaro in one day. And that was my personal...
Kilimanjaro in one day.
Yes, yeah.
Who on earth does that?
No.
Ultra runners actually do.
Runners, yeah.
Yes, like, so they do speed climbs, and I knew it was possible physically if you train and you're ready for it, and so I knew I was. So that's kind of where I was approaching this journey, but it was very different, very, very, very different.
What's
experience.
The difference in height? Mount Kilimanjaro is obviously in Africa. How high is that compared
to
what?
19,341 feet, and then Everest Base Camp is 17,598.
Okay, so they're comparable.
They're both hard. They're both hard altitudes.
Right. And then, so, all right, so you got there and you went up a little slower than maybe you wanted to push yourself, and you decide
kind of want to put into this conversation that we had two traveling agendas, two very, very, very different, because I'd already run the marathon, and I was choosing to purpose to go there to just show the story of the porters. And so I purpose to go with the porters and see what athleticism it takes for them to carry those packs and what they're up against to get everyone's gear from that start of that marathon down to the finish. So it was a two different process. But we found with the guides, they are so in tune to taking care of everybody that they even though I'd been there before, they would kind of like run back and forth. And so they had quite the challenge, because she's an incredibly gifted athlete and
she
very,
wants
very
to
strong.
Go. She wants to do it in a day.
And then they have me that's just out there, who can I meet? Who can I talk to? So, yeah, so we had, you know, quite a two different agendas going, but it's both of them are amazing, amazing, beautiful stories. And, you know, lots learned there.
So for you, Nadia, was it just to conquer the hill, or was it to meet the people along the way?
It's both. I didn't think it was all of the above. It's to fully immerse myself in the experience, and this is kind of why I love traveling. I've been traveling alone since I was, I think, 9. I took my first solo trip. I went to Canada. I asked my parents to send me to visit my aunt and uncle, and they sent me because like my older sibling, my sister, had done it when she was a little bit older, and I was like, I want to spend a winter over there because in SoCal we really don't have real winters. No. So like for me, traveling is very important to just fully immerse yourself into the culture, the food, the language. Everything. And I definitely have, this was probably my 32nd or 33rd country that I've visited in around the world.
Wow.
And so like I respect and understand that there are a variety of different cultures, and I want to be a part of that. I want to experience that. And so understanding like when we took off, like this is going to be a journey of the trek and be patient and take it all in. And then race the marathon. Like that was the goal. It did have to change a little bit while we were out there. More of a survival, maybe perhaps when it came to the marathon itself. But I'm glad everything that happened. I'm really glad that it did, because it humbled me, it challenged me, and it also was rewarding in its own unique way. And you know, I did enjoy it very much.
Wow. All right. So you guys are up this trek, and the purpose of the trek is what, to get there and then to get acclimated to the altitude. You have to spend day. I always read when they go up and conquer Mount Everest, when they try and climb to the top, you have to take days to go up there. You can't just sort of take a helicopter up and go up to the top here.
I think some people do. But let me give let me give some context, actually. So you can do the Everest Base Camp journey, the trek itself by itself. And I actually have a couple athletes who have done it, and like that's one of their bucket list items to do. And I try to do my research online and try to see, like, okay, how much mileage is it? How much gain is it? How, like, how many days does it take? Just so that I could try to see how optimally I could
do
it.
This is from wherever that you land in the airport. What's whatever the name of this airport on the top of the mountain is or something. You land someplace and then you have to go up to the
base. So when we landed in the main city in Kathmandu. And so we were there stuck for a couple days. And then finally we were able to take a flight out of Kathmandu and go
on a helicopter.
So Kathmandu is at about 4,000 feet altitude, approximately 4,300 feet. And then you take a small flight to Lukla. Most people do. So Lukla is known as the most dangerous airport in the world.
That's what Karen had said once before, because it's like literally carved on the top of this mountain or something.
So yes.
If you overshoot it, you go careening down the hill here.
Yes, right. I believe the runway is about 527 meters. It's one of the shortest runways in the world.
It's not legal here in the United States, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, and so very talented pilots are flying off of there. So it's actually labeled as the world's most dangerous airport, I think, because of the accidents that have happened there.
Yeah.
So it's not very comforting. Another thing is that...
No.
So Lukla is at 9,000 feet altitude, and we had our flight scheduled, and the thing is that you have a very small window of when you can fly into this mountain town, because mountain weather changes abruptly once it gets
fog,
into the afternoon.
Winds, yeah. All everything, yeah.
Yeah. So ours got delayed. It got delayed to like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and that's kind of what I read and I expected. I was like, okay, it's part of it. Just kind of wait. And then Karen's like, you know what? Let's just go. Let's just book. We found some seats into the helicopter. Let's book, because that's another alternative that you can do if you'd like to take a direct flight. So it was very fortunate that Karen had found those seats, and so all three of us were able to squeeze in. And we got into Lukla. And so once we're in Lukla, like, I was much more calmer because I'm now Kathmandu is very, very busy.
You said three of you. Who else was with you?
Our guide.
Our guide. Okay.
Suit up the trekking guide.
Yes. And so once we got to Lukla, like, it was around in the 57 degrees, 9,000 feet altitude, overcast, nice and, like, cool weather. And I was like, oh, okay, now we're going to begin. So our journey was set to be for six to eight days. That was kind of the wiggle room. And we already lost a day from the luggage.
So
now it was like 7 days. We're like, okay, this is like not a problem, even though that's actually shorter than the average person goes up.
So I think 7 days to
from
trek?
Lukla to the base camp. Yeah, okay. And I think Karen had mentioned that previously when she had done it in both times 12 days.
Yeah, I think most of the other marathons were doing it in 10 to 12 days.
Yeah, so that's actually standard. Like, most of the marathoners do it. Karen did it that way. And then a lot of people that just do the Everest base camp trek, they do it between 12 up to even 19 days. Those ones that actually struggle. So it's not so much the mileage and the gain. It's more so the altitude. A lot of people will get hit by the altitude in different ways.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why they take that time to acclimate. You know, you climb high and you sleep low. You climb high and you sleep low. I kind of explain it like when you're going up a staircase. You're going to go up three steps and you come down two. You go up three steps and you come down two. Hmm. So you have to be very patient with that. But I've been exposed to altitude, probably training, just enjoying it. And my family is from Ecuador, Quito, and Loja, which is about 8,000 to 9,000 feet altitude. So
this is nothing for you. This is just a walk in the park.
Come on, let's go here.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say, but I do see my body is able to adjust to altitude a little bit better than others, and that's kind of why I was able to do Kilimanjaro last year in a day. So that was our goal. Like, we're going to be doing it in 7 days. And we started our journey that evening from Lukla. And every day we were hiking. I kept track of all the data. So
Which is a good thing, because there isn't that much data out there. And that's what she was really struggling with. Is people in Nepal, they just tell you, oh, it's going to be 6 hours.
Yes. Everything is by time. And I'm like, that doesn't work with me, because my fitness is different from others, and also my pain tolerance is different from others. And if I'm already stuck at certain villages, then I mean, let's optimize our time and we have the rest of the day to like relax. So I was just like, what's the mileage? What's the gain? What's the, and like, no, it's going to be potentially.
It's just 6 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. So typically everybody is going to be hiking on average. I would ask so many questions to our guide, and he's like, typically every day is hiking between 6 to 8 hours per day. That's on average for the average hiker. Now, for us, he's like, maybe five. But after our first day, he's like, okay, you're cutting that like much shorter. So we were only hiking those first couple of days. Like, our moving time was about 3 hours. That's moving time. That doesn't count like the times that we would stop for pictures or stop for snacks or stop for lunch. So 3 hours moving time of hiking. And by like day three, then like Karen and I kind of went on our own pace. I kind of went ahead a little bit, and then we would catch up and we'd just take pictures and videos. So on average, it was between 3 to 4 hours of moving and hiking time, because we are like athletes, and because we are familiar with altitude. And so that's not the regular hiking pace. Like, we definitely we're going a little
twice
bit more.
And I hate to have to ask this delicately, but there's a little age difference between the two of you here.
Yeah, like a couple decades.
Couple decades. Yeah. Is that a challenge?
Experience counts for something, but yes. And there's a definitely different you know, fitness level of what I did when I knew I was going to run the marathon, because you've got to be. You know, you want to be. You want to be just mountain hard. You want to be hammer hard. So, we knew going into it that we had very, very different. But at the same time, we are both athletes, and we are still blitzing times that the typical tourists don't do.
Wow. Okay. And your guide can keep up with any or all of these? He's not going, hey, we
have to. Oh, no. Yeah. They are like billy goats.
They just run up.
Yeah. So it was very similar to observe all the guides and the porters and everybody that was out there, the Nepalese. Very similar to my experience when I did the Inca Trail Marathon. Mm-hmm. I would see the locals and the porters. They would just go up and down and with carrying a bunch of weight, and they move with ease. It was like, how? And they don't look that athletic. It's just they're very durable.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a physiology behind it, because they were born and raised there. Their body and their hemoglobin is very different, and so they can very tolerate it, like if it's sea level to them.
Yeah, right.
So something really, really exciting is the entry fee for Westerners for the Everest Marathon is pretty expensive, because you have to pay for the permits to be up there. And it's a standard $1,000 entry fee. For the Nepali or Nepalese, I guess, if they're a Sherpa with the last name Sherpa in the last three villages, they only have to pay $35. But if they're just a Nepali that has a different last name from a different village, like our guides from the Ray villages, RAI, they have to pay $200. Well, $200 is 6 months worth of wages to them, or it's a lot. So we were able to support Sudip and let him run the marathon, supporting Nadia, and it was a huge deal. Very few of the actual guides get to run it. And he without training, because he trains in his lifestyle.
His lifestyle is running.
Yeah, he's able to pop out there and pull up these miles, which
so
is exciting.
So it took you 6 days, when other people take 10, 12 days or more to get up there. Now what? And no problems acclimating? I always worry about getting sick or something here.
No, I did have a problem. I think we had problems at different times. I think Karen had a little bit of nausea and a little bit of altitude symptoms, I think by day three.
Day one, I think I picked up something from what they call the yak cheese, you know, that, because they don't have refrigeration up there. So, yeah.
I started having problems by day four. By day four, the moment that we were sleeping at 14,000 feet altitude and above, my body was not happy sleeping at that altitude.
Not happy. What are we doing here?
No. And again, I've done a few 14ers. I've done mountaineering routes. I've actually ran up and down Whitney a couple times, and so I'm familiar with like what it feels like to be at that altitude and how to struggle there. But the one thing I'm not used to and never have exposed myself to is how to sleep above 14,000 feet. And there's really kind of no way to do that here in Southern California. Like, nobody sleeps at the top of Mount Whitney. Nobody sleeps at the top of Mount Lingley. It's like, it's just that you don't see that. And so how do you really prepare for that? You don't really. Do you acclimate, or you go there for like 3 weeks at a time, which to me, I don't want to be away from home that long. It's already a journey to accommodate like my coaching business and be away for 2 weeks. 2 weeks was a long time for me, 16 days. And so...
So how do you sleep? I never thought of it. Is it just because it's cold, or is it just because of the oxygen level?
Yeah, that's another thing. That's another thing that was difficult about the trek and the journey is, as you get higher and higher, the tea houses, which is what they call the, like the little villages where you stay and you sleep, like basically their version of hotels. It's
which are huts.
Yes, they are. They're not like very well insulated. They're not heated. It's very cold once you get above 14,000 feet. So depending upon your cold tolerance too, and I have a very high cold tolerance for being a Southern California girl. Now, if I was from Minnesota,
I was going to say, we were talking about Minnesota earlier, right?
Yeah.
My relatives, I grew up.
No, I'm not that tough. but when I move, I produce a lot of heat. When I'm still, I don't. And so like I'm at rest. And so I would like to be comfortable when I sleep. But that's something that you have to kind of throw out the window. It almost feels like harder than camping. And I've done plenty of camping in my days and in my journey and my adventures. And so that's why I thought like, oh, it's not going to be that bad sleeping in the tea house.
It's just cold.
Yeah. But it's something about it that makes it a little bit harder. Maybe because you expect to be comfortable. And you're not. And I did research that, and I did see that in a lot of YouTube content, a lot of videos, a lot of blogs, a lot of like just online stuff. I was like, okay, how hard can it be when you're sleeping?
Do
up
you
there?
Sleep on the ground or on a wooden slat, or is it a real bed?
There
or?
Are beds, and then of course it gets a little bit harder and harder as you get higher. And I think
I think then it's foam on top of ice at the base camp.
Oh gosh,
and foam on top of ice that you're sleeping
on. You're sleeping on the glacier.
Yeah, but for me. On day four, when I had the trouble of actually sleeping, I actually woke up with a headache, and I was like, okay, this is the beginning of dehydration. This is the beginning of and I'm really good. I was really good about my fueling, about my hydration. I was on top of everything, like taking care of my mobility, taking care of my recovery, taking care of like my feet. Everything was fine. And it's just that it's kind of hard to hydrate when you're sleeping. So yeah. I woke up like if I'm exhausted and I'm sleeping 7 to 8 hours or something, and I wake up, I'm like dehydrated. I'm like, oh, my head's pounding. So by the time I'm 2 hours awake, I'm already have downed like 1 to 2 liters of electrolytes and my protein. So I had that system, but by the second day being at 14,000 feet, we were in Dinh Bo Che, and that's where I went completely south. It was really, really bad.
Your body wanted to go south. It wanted to go back down the mountain.
No, literally. I don't know. You know, what's crazy is that I've been competitive in racing and in sports for about 30 years, and I have never experienced altitude sickness, which is wild because I didn't even feel it in Kilimanjaro last year. I didn't feel it.
Doing it in one day.
Yeah, doing it in one day. And that's why I was trying to explain to like Karen when I did it. I was like, I hurried up and I had adrenaline and I had like all the like stress and norepinephrine like pushing through my blood. And so I made it to the top, came back down, and I was suffering and it was hard. But maybe my body just didn't have the time to actually be like,
feel it.
Yeah, yeah, to feel the oxygen deprivation. So sleeping at there, like your body's dying. It really is. Like think of like trying to muffle your face and have a mask over your face and your hand. Someone's trying to smother you, and that's how you're trying to survive up there and sleep up there. So it's just not survivable. It makes it extremely difficult. And so if you're not getting deep sleep stages in your sleep, and you're not recovering, and you're going to wake up already tired and groggy, and it compounds. All that compounding fatigue is just going to impact you more and more and challenges you more and more. So for me, I try to do everything that I could in regards to like try to combat the headache, the nausea. By day five, I had projectile vomiting. It was as soon as I drank a little.
Projectile vomiting?
Yeah.
That's like real vomiting. That's
yeah,
like
it was
shooting a target.
I think I was in the room next to Karen, and she had actually heard me that morning. She's like, oh.
Do I let her?
No, I mean, at that point, like it's just like your body's fighting it. It's just completely fighting. And I had the nausea. I had the reduced appetite. And I love food. I love eating. I have no problem. Like my GI tract is extremely like durable and strong, but I had to force myself. I had to force myself to drink, force myself to eat. And knowing that I was having these symptoms, I think then I started becoming very emotional and deflated because I felt like I was afraid my body was going to make the decision for me and stop me from continuing on. That's what was really, really, really demoralizing and disheartening. I felt defeated, and I was like, my mind was still like strong. I'm like, no, I'm going to keep pushing through, and I keep eating and drinking and doing whatever it is. Like, so I lost myself while I was sleeping. And so like that was out of my control. Like, how do I combat that while I was sleeping?
And that's not something, it sounds like in all the races you've done, all the different altitudes, that's not something you'd experienced before.
No, because I'm not sleeping in the middle of my races,
Right.
I've done stage races, I've really, I'm good at stage racing because I can optimize my sleep and my recovery in between and then be ready to go and go hard the next day and the next day and the next day. So this was just very different because you're not going hard
and
the next day.
And how do you talk to your body? Because you sound like someone who pushes your body. I don't care what the body's saying. We're going to keep going here. And the body's like, no, I think I'm going to make a point here.
But that's what she did, though. She's champion, and she just championed through that whole thing. And it's really interesting. Different bodies take different things. Even in running a marathon at sea level, you could be in the best of shape and then bonk or have your body do something to you, you know, in the length of being heated up in a marathon. And I was sharing that it was interesting that you've got this thing out there called long-haul COVID that people are suffering from. And
you're saying your son's suffering
from it. My son has been diagnosed as having that, and that it attacks the oxygen in your cell level, like your mitochondria. And interesting enough, as we went in elevation, I thought, this is actually putting the same symptoms that they experience from the
can't get up.
They can't get enough oxygen. So if they stand up real fast, there's not enough oxygen to go through all the cells, and it makes them lighthearted and faint and gives them, brain fog, and it wakes them up at night because their body is on alert because they're not getting enough oxygen and it won't let them go into that rest sleep. And I thought how interesting this is. Everything that I had to research for what he was struggling for equates as we get higher. And so they were saying that you need to, drink the, not just water, but electrolytes, and drink it while you're still laying down and feed your body
Do you have to somehow massage your legs on an airplane push the blood up or something?
The formula of things that you learn is, and then you're waking up in the middle of the night because you have to go to the restroom more often than usual in higher elevations. And so you have to go to the restroom, but if you jump up, all your oxygen is going to go rushing down to the legs where it's not there, and you're going to get dizzy. So I played with those formulas of massaging my legs. And by the way, I wasn't as packed and prepared as Nadia was, and I was so impressed with her readiness for this. She even brought a battery. What do you call the things that massage
her? Oh.
And I even, the second day out in the morning, I looked up there at breakfast, and I went, oh my gosh, how is your hair curled? How in the world
is
your hair curled?
Well, she's an influencer, too. She's always got to look good here. Yeah, right.
And she brought, rollers to, put in. She was just so amazingly packed and prepared.
What's amazing is
if you feel good, you look good, then you're going to do good.
Yeah.
What's amazing is I saw, like so many other people, some of these posts that you did that got like 100,000 views or more. I saw some of them. Karen was reposting them and whatnot, watching this journey as you guys are doing this. All I saw is happy smiles and dancing, and so it just looked like a walk in the park. It didn't look like projectile vomiting or long COVID or your body conking out.
Because we're special.
I didn't think I had it in me to pull out my camera while I was projectile vomiting. I didn't.
Want to see. We want to see the real stories here.
And then, even when I was crying too, I didn't pull it out. Like I felt that I needed to be, maybe because I was just so suffering so much. Because I have seen those online when like influencers will share when they're crying, and sometimes I'm like, I don't know how you take it out, and I couldn't because I was in the moment and I was suffering, and I just was like in my, I think because it took every little fiber to try to think about how am I gonna keep going.
I think that's why when you see people stand up that rock up in Everest Base Camp or in the tent when you're finally at base camp, so much tears. They're joyful tears, and they're tears of I have what it takes. I did what it took to get here.
I'll bet there are people, though, that do drop out along the way that do say, I can't make this. That do underestimate
it. What was the percentage that we found?
There is quite a few. I think probably what you see online and then what you experience when you're out there, it seems about maybe 10%. Usually, what we noticed was the larger groups, any groups that had like 15, 20 trekkers per group, they had like one or two people that wouldn't make it, and they had to come down on a horse or come down out of a helicopter. And that makes sense because if you think about it, like if you're in a large group, it's really hard to manage everyone's individual needs.
Right.
with a large group. And that's kind of what I had told Karen. Like, I want to hire a private guide. I want this to be my experience.
I gave her the best one.
We interviewed him the one time, amazingly.
Yeah. Suit up the trekking guide.
So like, that's kind of what my preferences were, because I wanted this to be a personal journey. So that's kind of what the hard part was when, like, I was suffering on day 4 and day 5. That's where I talked to Sudip. I talked to my guide, and he became basically me, who I am for others. I'm usually that strong person. I'm usually helping people navigate their emotions through their goals and through their journeys. And even within, like, family members, like, sometimes I'm known as that strong emotional mental person. And it was wild to feel so weak emotionally and mentally.
Yeah, right.
And I think it was just because of the fear of not trying to continue.
You don't strike me as somebody who often feels weak or vulnerable or doubtful.
I do feel those feelings, but I know how to navigate through them because I'm familiar with the feeling. I'm like, okay, let's get through this. Let's problem solve and let's navigate through this. But I think up there, I know somebody will make a decision for you if it becomes too, like, drastic on your own body. And I won't have that power. Like, no, let me be. Let me go on. It's like, no, sorry, you're going to have to get out of here, like, in a helicopter, because you can no longer continue. So, like, that's, like, I put in so much money into this. Yeah. I put in so much training into this.
So
and
much
also-
time, effort, money, emotion, mental preparedness. And all of a sudden, you hit a barrier and they say, you can't go.
Thankfully, though, once I had talked to my guide on Sudip, like, I told him he had one day of wiggle room on day 6. He's like, we're going to, like, split that last day and get to Everest Base Camp. And I asked him, I was like, you know what? As crappy as I feel, we need to, like, just go straight to Everest Base Camp. And then, like, for me to sit, I go, I need one day of decompression on the day before the marathon to actually consider surviving that marathon safely and without causing any permanent damage, because there is, like, you can cause permanent brain damage, you can cause permanent pulmonary damage, you can so I want to make sure that I make also a smart decision for myself. And so, like, he's like, okay, like, because he's very experienced and they know how to make the right decision for you, especially if you're compromised. So he's like, all right, let's go ahead and we pushed straight on the last day to the Everest Base Camp. That's why our journey was 6 days, as opposed to what the plan was, 8. Then it got shortened because of luggage to 7. And then it got shortened to 6 because I just needed that rest day before the marathon.
All right. So in the last 5 minutes of the show here, you did the marathon. Karen didn't do the marathon.
So here's my project is I really wanted to show, and I'm going to do a plug right here because I have a documentary coming out next week, and it's going to be called The Happy People. It'll be on my YouTube channel, Karen Ware Events. And what I wanted to do is show people the other athletes, and those are the porters, and what they carry, what they go through, and the athleticism and the excitement they have of actually reaching Everest Base Camp and getting all this equipment back to the finish line before they finish. And then I chose to stay an extra 10 days and go back to their villages 3 years later from the last time I was there. And see what their needs are, see what they're doing with the Take Care Karen salon. and it was hard, it was bold. I'm the only American that's ever done it, and it was to do Everest Base Camp.
We never go behind the curtain and see what's there. You just trust that these people will take care of you.
So that's going to be a whole nother story and a different story, but I wanted you just to hear, you know, the challenge of Everest Base Camp. And one of the things that we learn from these trips is that you learn from these trips. They're amazing. And we saw the porters carrying this incredibly heavy loads. But we also realized that we as Americans, us two women, very strong personality, very capable businesswomen, we have invisible loads here in the United States. And maybe
you
sometimes
you don't just leave the stress and worries behind when you head up the hill.
And maybe those loads are just as big and just as heavy. They're harder because they're not seen. And we were both discovering things that we were carrying. I was carrying that my son had taken this trip with me a few years ago, and because of long-term COVID and what he's struggling with right currently, he would never be able to do this trip this current year.
Your big, strong son is not strong enough to do it right now.
And then I realized that, you know, I was projecting a bunch of those fears on, you know, being uptight about everything. And so I learned a lot about myself.
It strips you down.
Yes, yeah. And you learn a lot about each other, too, on the trip. And we learned a lot about the people that we took there, my biggest reward and my medal is Lukla on the day back when we come back, because the money that I've stuck in my pocket over the year with the proceeds, I'm able to, from the races, not much. It's just me, one, you know, simple person, but I'm able to gift back to them and say, pick something in Lukla that you would never be able to afford. I want to send it back with you to your, and they'll pick something like a pair of trekking shoes or a phone so they can contact their family. And then I said, now pick something for your parents. And it was, and I'm going to, in the documentary, you'll get to see the footage of them going back to their villages with this product.
Well, that's what people don't realize when they come out to your races. You do fun runs. So they're fun and they're silly and they have a theme. Like you have, we're going to talk about the one coming up, the Pirates Run. But they don't realize that part of the proceeds go towards a real serious stuff here.
The whole reason I set these in motion is that I had to have funding, one, to get my own two kids off to college and get the inner city Mexican boys and the one girl off to college, you know.
Yeah, you got to live and you got to support yours.
And then run around the world. And then I ran into these needs around the world. And she's mentioned, too, because she's from Ecuador. You go to any of those small villages and you're going to meet some incredibly great people that you don't overhelp, but you can help. You know, you can start a little hair salon.
And often we probably don't think to help. It's just part of the process. You don't think of the people you leave behind there. You do a little bit, but you don't. They continue to live there and rely upon, live on very little.
And you know, they call the section that I trek back to the happy people. That's a little farming belt of people. And they really, truly, honestly are happy. And they don't have much, but they have each other, and they have camaraderie, and they have the things that we're finding that running does for us here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so anyway,
so quick summary: what was the actual marathon itself like, Nadia? Was it just like any other marathon, only at a higher level here?
No, it's a complete survival.
they build it as the world's hardest, highest marathon, and it lives up to its name. How's that?
Yeah, so the tagline that it is, and by fact, it is the highest marathon in the world, and then I would say it's one of the hardest of the world. They don't claim that title as the hardest, but it's one
of. But you'll give it to them here.
It's definitely challenging. I will say it's completely mesmerizing to do the trek. It is mesmerizing to wake up at Everest Base Camp and to see the magnificent Himalayas and to see the changing clouds and weather and just to understand that and recognize that you are there. It's a very, very beautiful experience, as crappy as I felt and felt like I was dying. I literally felt like I was dying, and maybe I was if I had stayed there a little bit longer. But it was mostly, once we started, one of the biggest things that I want to share is this whole journey. Maybe I was inspired to do the Everest Marathon and the Everest Base Camp Trek probably about 12 years ago when I did the Inca Trail Marathon. So I always knew I wanted to do adventures and I wanted to explore and see how I can give back to my community or make an impact. But this goal actually changed after COVID. Once I went through a very difficult time in 2020 and 2021, as many of us have, were going through a very challenging time. And so I was in a very dark place in my life, very low, and to the point where I didn't think I was going to wake up the next day. So when my dogs passed away, that gave me a new meaning, a new goal. I go, I want to take my dog's ashes to all the most beautiful places in the world. And by doing that, it encouraged me to continue to live. And it encouraged me to continue to not just survive each day, but to aim for something, to thrive and shoot for something. And so it was a very meaningful moment at the starting line of the Everest Marathon. I brought my ashes, the ashes for Max and Bruno, and I sang them a song. I sing them Somewhere Over the Rainbow and You Are My Sunshine.
My goodness.
And I spread their ashes. And so a piece of my heart is literally there at Everest Base Camp. And that was a meaningful moment. And I was like, okay, all you have to do in my head, like, just run downhill of this marathon.
It's not quite
and
just downhill.
Is it all downhill?
No, or is it so much uphill.
No, it's very technical. You're running on ice, you're running on rock, you're running on boulder, you're running on uneven steps, you're running on even steps. Probably only about 20% of it is runnable, actual runnable for us humans, not the Nepalese.
Yeah, right.
The Nepalese, they can move pretty quickly on those, and the locals can. You drop technically around 7,000 feet, 6,000 feet from 17,500 feet to the start.
Back during the course of the run?
Yes, but because you climb, you actually climb, I measured it, you climb 3,200 feet gain. So you are technically dropping over 9,000 feet in 26 miles on what? Technical terrain. So
and part of it, you go almost back up to the actual, what do you call it, altitude of the base camp. When you go to Dimbochi and you turn around, don't you go up a little higher?
Just a little tiny bit, but yeah. You're just around like 14,000 feet at that point. So okay, it's so. If you do, you climb about, I think, 600 or 700 feet.
It just felt like you're going
running
to
on ice, yeah. Dropping 9,000 feet doesn't sound like a run at the beach here.
No, no, it beats up your body. It really, really does. It's very, very challenging. And I will say there were 200 marathoners and about probably 20 ultra marathoners and maybe 20 half marathoners. And all of those people are really tough. In order to, it is expensive.
And triumphant.
It's expensive to go. It's expensive to do this type of adventure. But your expenses are contributing to the economy and to the families. And that's
clearly.
It is at least you're giving back to the community because it's their way of life. But the one thing I did notice is like all the runners, like just they're just tough people. They're all tough. Like you have to be wired a certain way to put yourself through that, and to also prepare yourself for that. Because I don't see anybody trying to think that they're going to wing this trip. You're not going to be able to wing it.
That's the message. Because I think, and many of us, and maybe you two are guilty of that a little bit too. I can do it. I've done this. I can just wing it. I can make it. Well, how tough can it be? How different can it be, or whatever? It sounds like it was different.
Yeah, very challenging.
For you to say that, I'm assuming it's like really challenging here. Right? When you admit something's really challenging, well, I didn't hear that running up and down Kilimanjaro was really challenging. I did it in the day.
It was challenging. So for me, I love climbing. So the climb was actually, I loved it. I thrive suffering climbing. The downhill was hard for me. So this marathon was really hard on me because my weakness now, or my strength isn't going downhill anymore. It used to be in my younger years because, again, I've been competing for 30 years. So, like, the 20s are your best years. For me, at least it was. And so it challenged my body.
Because you're putting what, more pressure on your legs as you run down or something?
It's just the impact forces. Yeah. And also it not being a smooth trail the entire time. You're going on technical terrain. So, just...
All right, so last question everybody's got to ask is, what's next? Are you going to go back again like Karen? Karen
keeps going over and over again. What's next is I need to talk all of you out there that are listening to this just to come out and do something
to get
fun,
the first
fabulous,
steps.
And you know, festive on flat ground.
Because you can't just go to Mount Everest without some preparation, without some learning, without some smaller races.
No, so we have a 5K happening on 4th of July at Irvine Valley College, and it's just to be patriotic and fun. And I'm going to demo, if you're watching this, the bling. You can't miss the hat.
Oh, that's worth coming right there for.
Yeah, and
the medals.
The medals. Because always make sure that you
medals.
Have moving parts on your medals. And because it is the 250th anniversary of our nation,
country.
It's on the ribbon.
Okay.
So make sure you come for all the bling. And I want to put another plug that Paul Roberts will be there.
I'm going to be there. I got to capture some of this because I'm always amazed at the people who drag themselves out. This is a Saturday or Sunday?
This will be on a Saturday this year.
Saturday morning.
4th of July in the morning.
On the 4th of July, and they get up and there'll be like, what, 1,000 people or something crazy thing there. And it's everybody, little kids, old people in their 80s and 90s, overweight people, thin people, large people, short people. Everybody seems to say...
We are the something for everybody and everybody
really,
races.
Yes. I mean, yes, there's some serious runners there, but there's an awful lot of people. That always amazes me at race. Just people who just want to get up and move. And maybe they're just recovering from a heart attack or, I don't know, a divorce or something. There's something that they're trying to overcome and they're just out
or
trying
just
to prove
just come to
themselves.
Have a good time and
sort
be
of like, in a sense, like she's saying, I want to just overcome something. I want to have a point. I want to be. I have a goal. I want to push myself to do something.
So go to Karen with a C, with the word Karen in it, C-A-R-E-N, where, W-A-R-E, events.com. And
this
check
one's
it out.
Called what?
And it's called the OC Irvine 4th of July, red, white, and blue.
There you go. And for Nadia, what could top this? Where do you go after this?
You know, every time you accomplish something big, it invites you to dream bigger. It invites you to want to see what else is possible. And I think it's a beautiful thing. I think sport has that, it gives you that opportunity. So for me, even, you know, you do ask that question. It's like after 30 years, like, and after the first marathon, like, what do you do?
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily have to go longer. You don't have to go higher. You don't have to. But for me, I love to see new places and love new challenges. And so I was actually looking for my birthday race, which is in about 3 months from now. I'll be turning 42. And I,
no, 42, get out of here.
Yeah, and I was looking at this dream race that I've been wanting to do for a long time. It's called Transalpine. It's 155 miles with 56,000 feet of gain over 8 days. So it's a stage race. And
Where is this in the world?
Swiss Alps.
The Swiss Alps.
You run across the Swiss Alps. And I'm not ready for it yet. That's the key word, is yet. My body is still coming back after a setback in 2020 and 2021. So now I'm building out a whole year of actually
there
adventures to get me ready for that. So in 3 months, I'm going to be heading to Canada and doing the Golden Ultra 3-day stage race for my birthday. And then I'm going to be taking my dad to run with the Tarahumara in October.
But with the Hutawada water here?
The Tarahumara, which is actually just similar to the Nepalese and similar to the people from our in the Incas villages as well. Is the Tarahumara is out in Mexico in the Copper Canyons. And
These are people that like run from ridge to ridge or something?
Within the canyons and in Yurique. So this, I went back in 2018, I believe, 2017, I ran the Ultra Caballo Blanco, and I always told myself I want to go back and take my dad. And share
so
that.
There's many challenges yet ahead. There's many races
adventures.
Still to run.
Yes,
many adventures.
Adventures.
Well, I hope you can come back and share some of these with us here, because I'm just an armchair traveler. I'm like her son. It's hard for me to get off the couch, much less get up and push myself up a mountain.
Yeah, and we don't want to tag them with that, because that's the hard part about long-haul COVID. People are tagging people that feel like that, but it's kind of like dealing with mono or something.
I don't want to make light of it.
They don't normally are not like that. That's why if you see someone that's struggling, that don't put a judgment on it, but just, you know, pull them up and nudge them. But unfortunately, that form of long term, it doesn't matter if you exercise, it doesn't matter if you sleep, it's still attacking your body. So
that's the lesson for all of us. You never know what's going to knock you down, but you got to figure out what's going to get you up.
Yes, thank you.
There you go.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much. How do they tag Nadia and follow along these journeys here? You call yourself what, the Iron Lady?
Iron Girl Nadia.
Iron Girl Nadia.
Find me on all social media platforms, mainly, you know, on IG, but I'm on
Instagram.
Yeah, good old Instagram.
Okay, and Karen Ware Events?
Karen Ware Events, I named it all the same. You can find me on YouTube, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me at KarenWareEvents.com. Hit the calendar section, hit the info, learn about the races. We do one major themed, fun, fantastic, big race in Southern California.
Well, I hope everybody listening will come out and say hi and give us a chance to interview you and find out your story when we show up at the Red, White, and Blue 4th of July race at Irvine Valley College on the Saturday, July 4th. What time does it start, like 8 or something?
It's 8 o'clock, 8:30 mass start.
Okay.
And we got live band going, you know, Dixieland.
Party. It's crazy.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you there. Thanks so much. What an amazing journey. I look forward to the next one. Thanks so much, Eric. Well, there you have it. One more reason to tune in each and every time as we continue to run these races and run into life with our host, Karen Ware, and her community. Right here on our community station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beal Applied Innovation.